Hey guys.
Yo, yo.
We have a fun interview today with Justin D'Angona. He is the National Frontline Campaigns Manager at Greenpeace. Emily is there for the interview. So in half an hour, expect her lovely voice to be back on the pod. But for the news, it's just me and James.
Yes. Also, if you're hearing this on Monday, that means yesterday was WrestleMania and it was the greatest day of my life.
Oh, are you going to it?
No, it's in New Orleans, so I can't.
But you're going to watch
it. I'm going to watch it later. Yes.
I still never will ever quite understand
why
I would never in a million years guess that you love WrestleMania. I mean, I guess it's surprising how much I love football to people. So
no, but football's a more normal thing. Like the reason why is because most people
it's so niche.
And but the thing is, like, anyone that watched wrestling, like, watched it when they were kids. And then they kind of got out of it. But then you watch something like WrestleMania and you see a stadium full of 70,000 people and you're like, oh, I guess people still watch
but
this.
But I've also known you for years and have never heard anything about WrestleMania, not a hint about it.
I mean, that's because no one cared, especially in college.
No one gave. That's the most confusing thing for me. It's just, I felt like one day you were like, yeah, dude, I love wrestling. I've loved it since day one.
I also love wrestling with the idea that there are major companies controlling our news.
Let's jump in. Great. So Sinclair, which is a major kind of broadcast network that controls a lot of local television stations. Somebody put out a video. I wish I could credit who it was, and I feel bad that I can't.
Well, there were a couple, because there were two versions of it. One where, like, it was kind of splicing everything.
That's the one
I watched. Another one where all of them were talking kind of at the same time.
Oh, no, that's the one I watched.
And that's the one you watched.
That's the one I watched.
Yeah,
so it's interesting. And this was covered too on Last Week Tonight, John Oliver's show. So if you watch that, you probably have a very informed opinion of it. But so this is from New York Magazine, written by Chaz Danner, where he says that new anchors are citing Sinclair propaganda is even more terrifying in unison. He wrote that over the last week or so, local television news anchors across the country have joined together to paradoxically warn viewers about the troubling trend of irresponsible, one-sided news stories plaguing our country. The identical, seemingly earnest editorial messages paid lip service to the importance of fact-checking and unbiased reporting, but they also complained about false news and fake stories. If that seems to echo the rhetoric of President Trump, it's probably because the statement was written by one of his allies.
It's important to note that some of those words were in quotations, because these are the words that were used in each and every broadcast. Whether it was a station in Texas, Michigan, like, all over, these places are reciting the same information and being forcibly told to read this off to their viewers.
Right. Oh, I completely forgot. It was Think Progress that rounded up many of the fake story segments for the video. And then Deadspin's Timothy Burke published a much more terrifying version, at which point shows 30 of the segments synced up in unison. So the anchors, and this is also from the article, says they were forced to read the so-called journalistic responsibility messages word for word by their employer, the conservative-leaning Sinclair Broadcast Group, the largest owner of television stations in the country. The features were one of Sinclair's now infamous must-run segments, consisting of conservative commentary that every Sinclair-owned station is required to air. Mm-hmm. There are some local news anchors that have come out and said it felt like a hostage situation.
Mm-hmm. It's been said to death, but it's very Orwellian, that you can't trust what you're watching now. You can't, because you're being fed one point of view, and that's supposed to be the view that everyone's supposed to subscribe to, and it's not. And it's hard, because now there's this whole speech about you have to watch out for fake news and all this, but yet that is the fake news now.
Well, I think it's interesting that in 2016, when the election happened, there was this big talk about fake news, and it was co-opted by the Republican Party, frankly, because there was fake news coming out. There was a lot of bullshit coming out about Hillary, about Bernie, about Democrats. And they said, well, this is fake news. We're getting a lot of a deluge of Russian propaganda. Mm-hmm. And then Republicans seized on that. And now it's turned into anything that's critical of a conservative policy is suddenly fake news. Right. And if you need more examples of that, Donald Trump tweeted, he said, so funny to watch fake news networks among the most dishonest groups of people I've ever dealt with criticize Sinclair Broadcasting for being biased. And then he wrote, Sinclair is a far superior to CNN and even more fake NBC, which is a total joke. I think that should go, that should tell you right there. If there's any, it's almost, Donald Trump is almost a, now, I mean, he is a watermark of if it's bullshit or not. Mm-hmm. If you're wavering on if something's bullshit and then Donald Trump echoes support of that, you know that it's bullshit. That's what he is now. He's a marker.
I wonder how this changes the landscape of America. I'm talking like past his presidency, you know, whether he's impeached tomorrow or whatever. But I wonder, like, how are we going to look back on this as our society? How are we going to, you know, there's such a divide in us right now. There's such an a mistrust in news, a mistrust in our government. And, you know, how are we going to bounce back from this? Mm-hmm. And then I don't think there's an answer for this right now. I'm very intrigued to see what will happen in our future, because right now I feel like we're at a pivotal point in our society where, you know, there's a certain segment of the country that's downplaying the efforts of kids trying to save their own lives.
Right.
You know, there are people trying to discredit a special counsel because the president doesn't want to be investigated. You know, like there's just so much that when you look at it from an outside perspective, you're like, what is going on?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, there is some, I would say, a rather moral right, if you will, that like we should all be able to objectively look at this and say, yeah, some of these things are wrong and we need to just like cut it.
Yeah.
But why aren't we doing that?
Right.
And so I'm very interested to see what happens.
Me too. I mean, we're in a dangerous place. Mm-hmm. So moving on. So stocks made a monster comeback. Dow rallies more than 700 points from lows of the day. This is from CNBC. Fred Imbert and Alexander Gibbs, where they write that after a wild session on Wednesday, stocks closed sharply higher as Wall Street erased massive losses earlier that came after China's announcement of new tariffs on U.S. goods sparked fears of a trade war. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed 230.94 points higher at 24,264.30, rallying more than 700 points from its session low. Microsoft and IBM were the best performing stocks in the index. So while the market did rally, I think it's interesting that we are entering into this trade war with China, which is going to cause kind of unpredictability in the marketplace. I am not an economic scholar by any means.
You aren't?
I'm not.
What?
But I do think that a trade war with China, which Trump seems to be ramping up, is not a good place to be. And what's even more interesting is Think Progress released a piece by Rebecca Entralgo that says Ivanka Trump's clothing company will be spared from tariffs thanks to her dad. Rebecca writes that the steel and aluminum industries in China will soon be slapped with tariffs up to $50 billion by President Donald Trump. On Thursday, after China announced their intentions to retaliate against the United States with $50 billion in tariffs of their own against U.S. goods, Trump warned that the administration would respond with another set of tariffs, this time targeting $100 billion worth of Chinese goods. Exempt from the proposed tariffs against China, however, is the clothing manufacturing industry. U.S. officials say that they used an algorithm to determine which goods to exclude from new tariffs. According to the Washington Post, the list was drafted to achieve the lowest consumer impact, ensuring goods like clothing and toys were excluded so as not to raise the cost on domestic consumer goods.
I don't believe that for a second.
No, no. Exempting clothing from tariffs provides a big break to American clothing companies that hold trademarks in China. One of those clothing companies belongs to the first daughter of the United States, Ivanka Trump. A recent report by the Huffington Post found that the president's daughter and closest advisor rakes in a total of $1.5 million a year from the Trump Organization while still working at the White House. Her dual role as advisor to the president and private business executive has continuously raised ethical red flags. No one can be entirely sure that the public policy by this administration isn't being driven by business motives or whether countries may pursue business deals with the Trump family as a means to curry political favor with the administration.
This is what I mean. Like, it's clear that this is what we talked about, the nepotism with Jared Kushner and being in a position that he should not have been in. We're talking about Ivanka now benefiting and getting so much money while also being an advisor.
I believe recently a judge in D.C., I could be incorrect on this, reopened an emoluments violation made mm-hmm. by Donald Trump. I mean, I think the issue with this administration is that there is so much rule breaking going on, whether it's a violation of the Hatch Act pre him being sworn in, mm-hmm. Whether it's violating the emoluments clause, whether it's obstruction of justice, collusion. Scott Pruitt, which we'll get to, mm-hmm. The head of the EPA, being very cozy with lobbyists. I think that there are so many rules being broken at such an unprecedented pace and so many rules being broken so flagrantly by mm-hmm. a sitting United States president that people, it's unsure of what to do. I mean, no one's ever been, I think the last time someone was tried for a violation of the Hatch Act was like 1870. Mm-hmm. And then you have a president who is currently receiving money while in office, which is a violation of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And people aren't doing anything
about it.
Yeah,
nothing's getting done.
It's flagrant.
Nothing's getting done. And this is why I'm worried. Like, why has no one taken the steps? I mean, I'm not saying no one, and I'm sure there's probably like one senator, one congressperson here somewhere that's like trying to get the movement going. But we all see this is wrong, and nothing's on the large scale being done. So that means there's just a bunch of people sitting on their hands just saying, oh, well, doesn't affect me.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's not good. That's not who we need leading this country.
Yeah, you know? I agree. I agree completely. So we were talking about Pruitt. I just wanted to get this too. So a Trump appointee at the Defense Department resigned after CNN revealed, very fake news, CNN reveals his birther postings. A political appointee at the Department of Defense, he resigned after a CNN K-file inquiry about controversial postings he made on Facebook. His name is Todd Johnson. He's a former Trump campaign state director in New Mexico who joined the Department of Defense in 2017 as an advance officer. A Pentagon employee with the sensitive task of providing logistical support related to the secretary's events and appearances domestically and abroad. Johnson had a pay scale of a GS-14, typically reserved for senior civil service positions. Photos and videos posted online show that Johnson's traveled extensively with Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis overseas and posed in photos with Trump and at the Pentagon, along with Mattis and former Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel. In September, Johnson warned friends on Facebook against posting or tagging him in articles about current events and politics. In July 2012, he shared a video titled Michelle Obama Admits Barack Obama's Home Country is Kenya, commenting, "People still don't believe." This is after Obama released his long-form birth certificate in 2011, showing that he had been born in Hawaii. That same month, Johnson also shared a video on his Facebook page with the caption, "I post, you decided." The seven-minute-long video cited the so-called Bible code to claim Obama was the Antichrist. Sorry, and this also comes from a CNN article written by Andrew Kaczynski and Nathan McDermott. I don't know what to say. And this is Trump. I mean, Trump still believes that Obama wasn't born in the United States. Mm-hmm. And this is an issue I guess maybe we shouldn't even be covering. The only reason we are covering is because he is a member of the administration, somebody who has taken pictures with the Secretary of Defense and with the president and is now resigning. But Trump will probably bring back. I mean, Trump's talking about bringing back Rob Porter. The guy who beat up two ex-wives.
And he's a really upstanding individual.
Yeah, he
has the best people.
This administration is trash. It's trash. I don't see anything good. There's not a single good thing. I mean, the Bush administration was awful, and we are giving way too much leniency with George Bush in retrospect. We're being way too kind to him. The actions committed by their administration tantamounted to war crimes at certain points in their administration. That being said, there were still programs that George Bush was involved in with funding for AIDS and HIV prevention in Africa. Mm-hmm. Other things where he wanted to do good. A lot of really bad, but I've never seen a president so... We were talking about this earlier, chaotic, lawful, good, you know, like the D&D things. There's chaotic evil, you know, chaotic good, chaotic neutral. I've never seen such a chaotically evil man.
I just think, if anything, Trump's presidency and his administration, it's a threat to our democracy. That's what it is. It's a threat to everything that our Constitution stands for. It's a threat to the people that he's supposed to represent. There is nothing. I don't see what good comes out of this administration or this presidency.
Nothing. There's nothing. Mm-hmm. He's also said that he's not going to go to the press correspondence dinner. I mean,
of course not.
Because he's this big, big, tough guy when he's behind his Twitter. Yep. He's such a keyboard warrior. But and then you get out into the open and he's chicken shit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so
embarrassed. Ever since he got slammed by Obama a few years back.
I was actually watching a video about that recently. Yeah, because he couldn't take a joke.
Yep.
Scott Pruitt, so who's the head of the EPA, has come under a lot of fire, and they're apparently Donald Trump wants to keep him on, but he is in a lot of trouble. So this is from an opinion piece from the editorial board at the Washington Post that says Scott Pruitt is unfit to serve, where they write that the blizzard of ethical questions surrounding Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt has become a Category 5 storm. Already facing big questions about his wasteful spending and relationships with lobbyists, Mr. Pruitt intensified his problems by dishonestly blaming his staff for one major ethical failure. Then the New York Times revealed that staffers who tried to rein in Mr. Pruitt's unnecessary spending were punished. More than ever, it is clear that Mr. Pruitt is unfit to serve. I mean, we're talking about people that are truly evil. Mm-hmm. Scott Pruitt is maybe the most damaging member long term of this administration outside of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. With the and we'll talk with Justin about all the great work that Greenpeace is doing. And thank God that there are people out there that are fighting the good fight. Mm-hmm. Scott Pruitt, I mean, the New York Times revealed Thursday that five EPA staffers who questioned Mr. Pruitt's lavish spending were reassigned or demoted. These staffers raised concerns about first-class travel, costly security upgrades, and expensive office furniture and renovations. One of them fought buying Mr. Pruitt a $100,000 per month charter aircraft membership, spending $70,000 to replace two office desks, and wasting $43,000 on a soundproof booth in the administrator's office.
For what? For what?
That's because all he does is meet with big oil.
He does. So he's getting the money from these corporations, and what is the soundproof booth maybe to I don't know.
Soundproof booth is hard to say.
It is. Soundproof
booth.
Booth.
Soundproof booth.
That's a new acting warm-up.
Soundproof booth and a booth proof proof. I don't know.
What was that?
I don't know. I tried.
Okay.
Red leather, red leather.
But yes, again, this is just another example of a person in a high profile position who's using it and abusing that to get money for themselves. This is not money that's going to any kind of protection for our environment. No one is seeing the results of that but him.
Yeah.
He's getting that money. So it's terrible.
It's, yep. Yeah, it's ridiculous. And just another issue that's happening. So there was also the lawyer who lied to Mueller about the Russian spy gets 30 days in jail. Excuse me. This is a Bloomberg article by David Voracos and Eric Larson, where they say that a Dutch lawyer who lied about his contacts with a top Trump campaign official and a reputed Russian spy was ordered Tuesday to serve 30 days in prison, becoming the first person sentenced in special counsel Robert Mueller's sprawling investigation. Alex van der Zwaan, he's 33, a former associate at U.S.-based Scott and Arp Slate, Miga and Flam, and the son-in-law of Russian oligarch, German Khan, he's a Russian oligarch whose first name is German, was also ordered to pay a $20,000 fine. Van der Zwaan faced up to 6 months, in prison after pleading guilty on February 20th to lying in an interview with prosecutors and FBI agents. He admitted to misleading them about his discussions with Rick Gates, Trump's former deputy campaign chairman, and about his work with a man who prosecutors say was a Russian military intelligence officer. But, you know, this Russia investigation, it's nothing. It's a whole big nothing sandwich, according to the Trump administration. Trump is also, I think this week they said that he is not a target of the criminal investigation, but he is still a target for obstruction of justice. But they said at the moment, which means
they could still be investigating.
At any moment, yeah, he could become part of the investigation.
I mean, again, I don't know anything. I'm not a lawyer. But I would think that if they were having enough evidence to say like there was some criminal charges or basically what I'm trying to figure out is, could Trump then, because he benefited from the actions of others, then by proxy be involved with that? Like if you're the recipient of people's wrongdoings, because mm-hmm. I think certain crimes you can be an accomplice just because like you had the car that hit somebody that someone used to run over. You know, like something
Well, I think it's just how much he knew.
Right. And which I think he has to know something. Like there's no way he had a whole team of people that just kept him in the dark the entire time and got away with this shit.
Right.
You know, I think he had to know something was going on.
Yes, I agree. Let's get some good news.
Yeah.
Let's get some good news and then we'll make it a little short. So we'll get into our really fun interview with Justin. Mm-hmm. So this is from a Vox article. Do you want to take this one?
Sure. Wait, give me one second. So I was like trying the document I'm reading. It just like clicked at me. Okay. So yes. So this Vox article by Andrew Prokop. Liberals just won a seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court by a huge margin. Huge. So liberal candidate Rebecca Dalet, or we could say Dalet. I'm not sure. But either way, she has won the election to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, according to the Decision Desk. Dalet defeated her conservative opponent for an open seat, Michael Skronok, easily, and her victory will cut the conservative majority on the court from 5-2 to just 4-3. Dalit's win is yet another example of liberal voter enthusiasm in state and local elections held during the age of Trump. And in Wisconsin specifically, it's a rare victory for a Democratic Party that's been beaten again and again in recent years. The race was technically nonpartisan, but Dalit was the Democrat-backed candidate and Scrinok the conservative-backed one. So this is actually just a really cool thing. It's especially in a state with Paul Ryan taking the helm. You know, it's really nice to see that, again, more engagement in these special elections.
Yeah.
This it's really huge, and people need to start paying attention to these things, because this is how it's going to get done. This is we talk about it a lot, but the midterms in November, they are so huge and so important to getting the right people in office.
Yeah,
you know, this is a pivotal point in our country, and obviously we saw how in the past year and a half what the Republican majority is and is not, and I emphasize is not, doing for this country. So this is why it's so big. And speaking of which, I would like to talk about a candidate we should all get excited about.
Do it.
So Noah Phillips is running for district attorney in Sacramento. Now, for those who are familiar, Sacramento is has a huge problem with crime, especially that with gun violence and things like that. So Noah Phillips... this guy's great. I've had a chance to look at his website, phillipsforda.com. Mm-hmm. If you go to his issues, he's got a lot of stuff to talk about. He's working on crime prevention. He wants crime reform. He wants to protect immigrant communities. He wants to reduce gun violence. He wants to end the failed 1980s drug war on low-level, nonviolent drug offenses, which I think is huge, because that's what's incriminating a lot of people of color, and especially our young people, which he also wants to help out with that. He wants to create second chance programs for people who have been involved in the criminal justice system. There's a lot of things like when you read through this and you watch some of the videos that are on his website, he is definitely someone who's not just talking about something just to get your attention. He really wants to make some reform. So I encourage everyone, especially if you're in Sacramento, check out phillipsforda.com. This guy is huge, and I think he's definitely someone that you need to keep on your radar.
100%.
Awesome.
What do you think? Should we get the interview?
Yeah, let's get to our interview.
All right, guys. Stick around. We have Justin D. Angona. We are super excited. It was a really fun interview, and we're excited for you guys to hear it. He's the National Frontline Campaigns Manager at Greenpeace. So stick around.
Bye. Bye. All right, everyone, welcome back to We Rebel. We have a very exciting interview coming up right now with Justin D. Angona. He is the Frontline Campaigns Manager for Greenpeace. So, Justin, welcome to the pod.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Yes. All right. So how we usually start this off is we ask somebody, you know, what was your start in your activist career? You know, what was the spark that made you want to get involved in the way that you have, or maybe in other ways, too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a tough question to answer, and I've had to answer it before. Mm-hmm. And I think when you look back at your life at any point, you're like, what was the jumping off, like, or stepping off the curb moment?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there were a lot. Like, I grew up in a small town on the coast of Massachusetts. And as a kid, like, the beach was like the center of the town. Like, that's where everything, it was like, that was the center of where everybody hung out. A lot of tourism came into the town. And it started to disappear when I was in middle school, because four-wheel drive vehicles had ripped up the dune grass that held like the whole ecosystem together. Mm-hmm. So it started to erode into the ocean. So when I was in middle school, the town basically rebuilt the beach so it wouldn't disappear. And it was kind of wild as a young person to see this thing that I loved like almost vanish because of human activity and then have to be rebuilt. And then the rest of my, you know, time was on like a kind of a fake beach.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my first jobs is working on that beach as an endangered species protection officer, where I safeguarded the nests of rare plovers and terns. Which
that sounds like such a deep responsibility.
It really wasn't. It's like I had like a notebook and a whistle.
Oh,
and
okay.
Like, somebody tried to walk their dog by the nest, and I'm like, hey.
Oh no, my gosh.
Get out. Yeah.
Don't you.
Yeah, but there was also like ropes and signs. So mm-hmm. most of the time it was just me alone on a beach, like mm-hmm. and you know, for 13 hours.
Wow.
And I would read, which I wasn't supposed to do. But I think that they're sort of like, they had like these things that are like sort of floating, but and then going to college and getting involved in like some of the anti-war protests and the movement happening around that time during when George W. Bush was president, and being like generally just very angry and frightened. And I remember one day in school, I went to Whittier College in like Southeast LA, and, you know, was studying sociology and sort of seeing how like various forces and structures like converge to create like society and the problems of society. And like, it was like, I felt like a moral obligation to do something about it. And I remember a specific walk that I went on where I was like, I think I was a junior, and I was like, I got to figure my life out. Like, what am I going to do with this time I have? And it was like a very deliberate, like internal monologue where I was like, where should I try to make an impact? Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, the environment seems like the umbrella issue, because it's everything. And it's how we like engage with the natural world and treat it as resources and distribute those resources in a way that like creates, you know, social dynamics. And so I sort of knew, I kind of like decided, I think at that point, like that I had all these like feelings, and I wanted to do something about them. And so I first started getting active, I guess. I thought like, well, maybe like the way to do it is through like creative expression. And so I tried to do, like I started working in doing some film stuff, and made like some documentary stuff about homelessness and access to birth control, and working with different friends and people that I knew at school. And then one of my friends from college actually got a job with Greenpeace, which is how I realized that they were doing stuff in the Southern California area. Mm-hmm. And I did some like volunteering and some activity at the local level. And then I was like, maybe I could do this full time. And so I decided to work for Greenpeace. And at the time, the only job they were hiring for was the job of a fundraiser, which I thought I would be. I was like, I could argue with people about these issues or like harangue them. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if I could do that in a way that would raise funds. And so that was the first, like, I think that was the, there was like series of things I was doing, I guess, that were more like like personal mm-hmm. efforts. Then there was this decision, like there's like you can work for the resistance, like kind of an opportunity mm-hmm. that I took, and then I got involved in Orange County.
Nice. So and so you went from, let's see here, frontline. I'm looking at your LinkedIn.
Oh man, wow.
I am currently creeping on you online.
The information. Mm-hmm. So you went from frontline fundraiser / senior team leader to senior city coordinator and then semester coordinator. So like, what is that rise like? And then what, I guess expound a little more on Greenpeace semester coordinator.
Sure. So yeah, I started out as a fundraiser. I think you all have seen people in front of your Trader Joe's or on the sidewalk before, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I am curious, can I ask, like, do you stop and engage, or do you cross the street?
It depends on the time, mm-hmm. I think. I've engaged before, but there are other times I feel terrible.
Well, I was curious because my theory that like it's hard to confirm because you don't get to do the study afterwards. Mm-hmm. But I've always felt like people who cross the street are the people who care the most, and they know that they can't stop and talk, or mm-hmm. they're like, "Oh fuck, I'll do this."
Because nothing's worse than like, you know, someone coming up to you and say, "Do you care about gay rights?" And you're like, "Oh my god, I do, but I really have to go right now." Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's how. Yeah, I feel like my reaction is normally, I either am already giving to that organization because I am, I do work in a version of the nonprofit world and I know how fundraising happens and I like feel for them, or I like don't even have time, but they're like, do you care about children dying? And I'm like, I mean, yeah, but I also care about my groceries happening in 10 minutes because then I have to do something else. It's like, whoa.
Yeah. I like to, when we do, because I host a comedy show and we raise money for various charities. And so my favorite thing to do is shame the audience because they're sitting and can't get away.
Yeah.
So when we auction off items.
Oh, he's very good at the mother guilt.
Yeah. I will look down. And yeah. So
I actually think that like humor is such a valuable tool in holding people accountable because it allows you to do it in a safe way.
Yeah.
I also like the, we were talking about comics earlier, you know, pre-recording, mm-hmm. and Eddie Pepitone has like a joke I've seen him do where he'll say something and if it doesn't land, he'll wait a beat and look at the audience and say, "You're really lucky to see me." you really are.
You're lucky to be here.
What a treat for you people.
Yeah.
And actually, I think all that sort of goes into like communicating about things that matter in a way that's not going to make people feel weird or not want to engage.
Yeah.
So I started out doing that, like talking to people in the streets. And I sort of joked that like I was already bothering people like for free. Like I was, you know, I feel like at that point when you're a passionate person, you have a sense of like, you know, like of conviction about issues, like you're going to find yourself talking to your family and your friends and people that you feel like maybe don't care as much as they should or aren't doing enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so that part of it was easy, but it was like, I was surprised at how much I enjoyed the process of like activating people.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought of it as sort of like, you don't want to talk to people that don't care or aren't interested, because that's not fun for anybody. Mm-hmm. But every day you have like 30 at bats with people that do care and are like, okay, I can talk to you for 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you have like a short window of time to help people get over the stories they tell themselves about why they can't do more, mm-hmm. or maybe aren't aware that there's like, that there are ways to organize and have a bigger impact mm-hmm. outside of their individual actions.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sort of like the process of fundraising. I think if you do it well in that, with that approach, it's kind of like getting people over their own like roadblocks and hurdles
mm-hmm.
until they get to a moment where they get to choose like and step off their own curb. Like they're like, you know what? Now that you mention it, I have known the rainforest was in trouble my whole adult life. And I haven't really spent too much time thinking, like I've felt bad. There's a lot of times where I felt bad. I've like marinated in the shame space, but I haven't like thought about what I could do about it. Or I guess I didn't know that there was something I could do about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So maybe now I'll make that choice. And so I think that I started to do that work. I really enjoyed it. And then at the same time, I was organizing volunteers in Orange County and in Los Angeles
mm-hmm.
While I was doing the fundraising work. And I feel like I got good at, I guess, connecting people to a sense of purpose and then mobilizing them to do things.
Yeah.
And so that volunteer organizing activity, I guess, gave me the experience to then go work with students. And I co-ran a training program that set college students up to work on environmental campaigns on their campuses.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. And you know, and so going back to the whole thing about people coming up to people and asking them, you know, if they want to get involved, you know, I think a big fear is that they say, well, this is such a huge issue and I don't have time.
Yeah.
So like, you know, so what are some of the things that Greenpeace does so that people like, you know, even if it's 5 minutes of their day, what can they do that that's something that they can help take part and make things better, even if they can't dedicate their full time to the issue?
Right.
Yeah.
I think, well, I feel like it doesn't get any easier than someone flagging you down.
Right.
Like they make the time for you, which mm-hmm. I kind of felt like, you know, after me, I'd always like kind of laugh to myself in my head. I'm like, this is as easy as it will ever get. I'm literally telling you to do this.
This is the mm-hmm. moment.
It's like a personal trainer for your karma. But I think that I think it's important to recognize the value that organizations like Greenpeace have, and like that NGOs, and there are NGOs and nonprofits trying to solve whatever problem you're stressed about.
Mm-hmm.
There's a team of dedicated professionals working on it full time, and like it's cool to sponsor that.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think that's like a sort of, there's an ethos of that. I think maybe that a previous generation had, and I think maybe globally it's a little different how people like that. It's sort of expected that like some part of your activity and finances go towards like participating in society
mm-hmm.
in a non-governmental way.
Yeah.
And maybe a higher expectation about being politically active. But I feel like if you're concerned about the world that you live in and you want it to be different, and you're not like using the tools that you have to do that, like supporting organizations that work to affect change or being politically active personally, you're missing opportunities to have an impact.
Mm.
And so I think that like for, if you're someone who's listening and you're like, if you're feeling that like feeling of wanting to make a difference, I would think about the issues that matter most to you and just do a survey of the landscape, and look at some of the groups that are trying to make an impact and affect change and see what resonates with you and your values.
Yeah.
And support them.
And so, and now, that's awesome, first of all, but, so going from Greenpeace semester coordinator, then director of special projects, now you're national frontline campaigns manager.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just want to know. I want to know all of it.
The second part there. Well, I'll talk about the Greenpeace semester program, because that was a really awesome experience.
Oh, yes, that too, yeah.
So it was this, like, did you ever watch the MTV, like, spring? There was, like, they did a show once where it was, like, a semester at sea.
Yeah, yeah. I watched like, all that stuff.
Yeah, it was, like, the Real World Rose Rule.
I feel like I was the star of that. Yeah. That was it?
Oh, my gosh.
It was like it was like a semester with Greenpeace. Mm-hmm. So instead of being a semester at sea, and there was a training curriculum that I, it was sort of set in place before I got to the program. And there was people before me that built it up, but myself and my co-coordinator, like, curated the curriculum, designed the trainings, and then mixed that in with, like, it was based out of our Washington D.C. headquarters, so we'd have a bunch of, like, special guests and issue experts, campaigners, people from other organizations. That would come in and, like, basically give a student everything that they would need to know to go back to their campus and design an issue campaign. And then part of the semester involved getting real world campaign experience. So every semester we would do 2 weeks in the field working on, like, a whole bunch of different projects, which was super cool for me too, because I got to travel a good deal of the country and meet all these extraordinary people and be part of these amazing projects, like going to like Appalachia to where to mountaintop removal sites with students, and then going then like where coal they blow up mountaintops to get coal, to extract coal, and then the coal was then transported to, this was, I think we were in West Virginia, and then we went to the neighborhood around where the coal, like, not necessarily that coal, but coal was being burned by a company called Duke Energy, which is the largest energy utility in the U.S. They had a bunch of power plants in North Carolina. We got to do a door-to-door canvas to organize ratepayers to try to lobby or push Duke to shift their money to renewables and stop burning coal and dumping coal ash. And just, like, met these incredible people. Like, we met a woman who had worked in the coal factory, and then, like, saw, like, after getting sick and seeing how bad it was, like, flipped and became an activist. We met a, and was like, so, like, on, at her door, like, so great to, you know, she was already doing work with a different group and was like, so great to have you here. And so I think for students to get to see that kind of the sort of the story of an issue firsthand, and while getting some experience doing tactics that were, you know, grassroots tactics, really, like, galvanized their spirit and inspired them to, like, commit to a course of activism, which is one of the objectives of the program.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and students went to back to their schools. A lot of them ran really successful campaigns, like around divesting their schools' endowments from fossil fuels, or getting their cafeterias to change their procurement policies so they're only selling sustainable seafood, or cutting their, a lot of, like, Greenpeace does a lot of really great, like, corporate campaigns, like market, trying to move the market. And so, like, an example of that strategy would be there's like a there's palm oil coming from Indonesia, and that's largely why the Indonesian forest is being clear cut, so the palm oil plantations can be put in, and that there's sustainable ways to raise palm oil, but if the traders are not using sustainable methods, you can impact their behavior on the ground by getting their business-to-business customers to cut their contracts. And so if a university network says we're not going to buy products that have this palm oil from this company in it, then that's going to shift where the money goes, and that will ultimately affect their decision making.
It's like activism based sanctions almost.
That's a good way to explain it.
That sounds like, because it just reminds me of, like, you know, when the United States will sanction a country, and it's like, you shouldn't have these weapons. And that's sort of money talks.
And those sorts of campaigns where you're, if you're directing your energy at the right target, you can have a really big impact in a way that, like, I think people are familiar with boycotts, which I think was a really big strategy at one point. But, like, all of us individually not buying Coke isn't going to affect Coke at all. But getting, but if you have a business-to-business relationship and you're able to, like, use brand damage or use the leverage of a large contract with an institution that has some, you know, you have access to influence, you can have, like, a very big impact. And so I think it's one of the things you would try to train student organizers to do is to be able to communicate that to their classmates, like, how can we, like, work strategically to have, to, you know, create the world that we want to see.
I think that's so fascinating. One of the things, this is loosely related, but I always thought it was kind of interesting, like, because we're, you know, currently in a trade war. And I think it's so fascinating that sometimes the European Union will put specific sanctions on things. Like, right now, I think they're threatening to put sanctions on cheese because Wisconsin is a main exporter of cheese, and then bourbon, which comes from Tennessee, and Mitch McConnell is the Senate leader from Tennessee, and Paul Ryan, the House leader, from Wisconsin. So I think it's very interesting doing these like very specific attacks on things and saying like, you know, this is a big company, we will remove, they will no longer, or a university will no longer buy from your company if you don't have a sustainable resource. I think that's fantastic, and a really I like a macro kind of attack to change, frankly.
Yeah. I think it ties into some of our other interviews. Like, we interviewed a woman who started an organization called Drain the NRA, and it's kind of the same thing where they follow the money.
That's a great name, by the way.
It is.
Isn't it cool?
Yeah. She was really cool. We liked her. But it's interesting because, I mean, whether we want it to or not, like, money connects, cuts through all the silos of the issue areas. But I think that also presents a lot of challenges because of obvious reasons. But I'm curious, in that process of trying to do these bigger pivots, you know, what are some of the challenges that Greenpeace has come up against, and or how does it trickle down to like your kind of position now?
Oh man, that's such a good question. I think that there's some like, there's like bigger like conceptual challenges. Like, sure. If you're asking for, like, corporations already have outsized influence and power. So if you're appealing to them directly, like, it sort of reinforces that paradigm. When they do decide to operate like more sustainably and more ethically or socially responsible, in a more socially responsible way, they can have a big impact, but they're voluntarily capitulating to your demands. So they could easily change their mind the next day. There's not like, you're not getting like the permanent victory you might get from a law, and there's no enforcement mechanism other than like the market.
Yeah.
So it's like, I think of the way that I think our campaigners think about this is it's like, it's one piece of a long-term plan, but the gold standard is usually like a regulation or a legal protection or a shift in policy to like concretize the change that you want to see. Where I think it gets interesting for me in my role now and in the past, it's like, how do you give regular people like tools or tactics to impact that sort of a target? And how do you do that in a way that's like where it feels like real and impactful and fun? Because people don't want to do stuff that's like a slog.
Yeah.
And that is sort of, so my role now, that's one of my challenges is like I work with campaigners and issue experts to come up with grassroots tactics for a distributed network of volunteers and activists around the country. And it's like, yeah, how do you one example would be like plastic pollution is an issue that we're working on right now. That is an overwhelming thing to think about for a lot of people. Like there are giant trash gyres in the ocean. And I think the statistic was recently called into question, but they're like, we're on track to have like parity between plastic pollution and fish in the next, like, which I don't know. I think that I put an asterisk on that. I think that might, that, sure. But that there's like, or like the trash recently in the news, the Pacific trash gyre was found to be 4 to 16 times bigger than we previously thought.
You say four to 16?
I know. Big range.
I'm not a scientist, so I'm like, that seems like there's, you could probably dial it in a little bit.
Wow. Yeah.
But it's,
oh my God.
It's a huge problem, and a lot, and that, you know, things that we throw away don't ever really truly disappear. And then there's a whole host of problems that come along with that, like the toxins from that waste get into the food chain and bioaccumulate through fish to the large predators that are already vulnerable because they're being overfished. But then we eat them, and then it's like they're sort of concentrated pollution in, you know, and so it creates this big ripple effect through the whole ecosystem. And so how do you give a person a way to solve a problem like that without overwhelming them with the size of the issue?
I feel like you need like a 3D interactive war room where you can walk in and be like, I want to think about plastic today. And you like press a button and all the plastic stuff lights up and you see how the individual can connect to Greenpeace, can connect to the long-term restraint. Like, how does Greenpeace keep track of all these
things? Pitching right now?
I'm pitching, and I can do that for you.
Yeah, if you want to
Silicon Valley, if you're listening.
But like, how?
I would love that. That'd be great. Have one of those like Minority Report touchscreens.
Because like, how do you
catch polluters before they pollute?
Yeah.
They also have that on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but that's a whole other story.
So like
how does Greenpeace track it?
Well, the first step that a campaign begins with like lots of research. So you need to like have a deep understanding of the issue that you're working on to like to go any further.
Yeah.
And we have some great people on staff that do that. And they're like, that's what they do. They're professionals. And then campaigners that have all different kinds of backgrounds. Some of them have legal expertise. Some of them used to work for industry. So mm-hmm. they know it from the inside out. So they have like insights to then pair with the research to develop strategy. Where I come in is connecting people to that work. And so like one thing that we're doing now, which is like an easy thing that almost anybody can do, is going to, when you're living your life and you see ridiculous packaging, like a banana that's peeled and then wrapped in saran wrap, like a fruit that already comes wrapped by God or whatever, you know, by nature. It came with the wrapper.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
And then it's like saran wrapped on a styrofoam thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sharing that on social media with the hashtag break free from plastic or pointless plastic, and then tagging the company that's selling it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a way to like, there, you know, I feel like everyone knows that there are people at companies that are like paid Twitterers and social, they're managing.
Yeah.
They're, what are they like, community managers on social media? So there's somebody who's like getting paid to be like, something, oh like no, that.
It's their yes. job.
People are mad. And
then
so
they
that,
have to like pass it off to the PR agent. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or answer the question, which that poor soul.
But yeah. The Wendy's person on Twitter is brilliant.
Whoever that one sidebar. Man is.
Or woman.
Or woman.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Oh God. I'm the bad guy of the podcast. Yeah. I don't know. sorry, what were you saying though? You were saying about on Twitter.
So the point is, so we have ways now to communicate with companies, and so if it becomes a big enough thing,
mm-hmm.
they're like, oh, this is a bad look. And especially if it's not their core business, like Trader Joe's is not in the business of making plastic waste. They're in the business of selling very delicious food.
Yeah. Well, and they've changed.
Wonderful prices.
And the business of taking things off right as you fall in love with the product, they take it out and they rip it away from you.
Did you know that they're no longer doing, so it's interesting you bring up the plastic thing. My girlfriend is trying to make our house plastic free. She's a wonderful mm-hmm. human. And so we use reusable bags when we go to the grocery store to put it in. And then you can just weigh anything you want on those bags. And we were pleasantly surprised because recently we went to Trader Joe's and they no longer, all of their bags are compostable. They become, so they're little plastic bags that you put fruits in or like anything like that now can become a natural part of compost. So
yeah, there's tons of great alternatives.
Changes, yeah.
And if you're a company, if you're like, if you can become a big enough issue where you're like, oh, this is becoming a problem, then you enter the next conversation, which is like, well, what are the solutions?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So let's solve it. It's a little more difficult if you're dealing with an industry that's like main product is awful.
Yes.
Like big oil where you're like, well, what if you were an energy company and you took your money into solar and wind? Like that's, I think the...
It's a harder hill to climb.
Yeah, it's a different sort of strategy you have to have.
But. Yeah.
Basically, your entire business model is wrong and let's fix it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I know I told you I'd ask about this, so I do have to ask about this. This is a bit of a turn.
Okay.
But you did a Vogue photo shoot. I just want to know about it.
I
want to chat about it. I was so intrigued by this.
Yeah,
I think this is like a, I know we're like, and get the companies and take down their funding and let's make change. And I'm like, well, this time you were in a fashion magazine.
Yeah.
It's a little turn.
I think doing like good things should feel good and be like, it's weird that we have this expectation that like, anything that's like virtuous should be a joyless slog.
Uh-huh.
It's not a very like sexy like frame. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's like, I think we have to move away from that. Like, and I think that's happening culturally. I think like there's a much different conversation happening now about activism than I think when I was in college.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
There's like some social cachet to it. And I think people are having fun with it. Like I love those slideshows of like best protest signs.
And
like
yes.
sometimes
oh
I worry
gosh.
A little bit. I'm like, this is a little too clever. It's a serious issue. Like, let's balance it out. But, but yeah, I think that like, it was a funny thing to get to do. A friend of mine worked at the magazine and was organizing a photo shoot, and they wanted, I think, like stylish environmentalists. And
is that in your LinkedIn too?
It's not. Yeah, I don't. I don't describe myself.
It's on
as
his
that.
Business card, everybody.
You got a cool look. You got a cool look.
Well, thanks.
Oh, yeah, you guys can't. Listeners can't see it, but
it's very.
We rebel seal of approval. So.
Kind of you to say.
Yeah, we're. Yeah.
I think Nick has a crush.
Yeah,
so
I think
interesting.
So.
It's very. Oh,
we appreciate our guests. All right, I'm involved. Well, as you were saying.
Yeah.
Excuse my co-host.
She's a really sweet person, and I guess was and thought of me and reached out to me and said like, can you come to New York to do this shoot?
Mm-hmm.
I was living in DC at the time, so it was easy. So I did. And it was a surreal experience to go from working for, you know, an environmental nonprofit where it's a great place to work. And there's you feel like you're part of a team with a mission, but there's not a lot of like glamour necessarily. We have a coffee machine, but like people at the Vogue Street were like, would you like some fresh fruit? And I was like,
you were like, is the banana peel still on it? Because otherwise,
is it rocking the God's wrapper?
I'm like, yeah, is this a trick? Like, you know, sort of like, you don't.
How much waste does this photo shoot produce?
Yeah. Well, you're all talented. You've been talent. So talent gets treated differently than like the production assistant.
Which is absurd because I feel like everybody should be treated the same.
I've also been a production assistant. So yeah. That's
very true. Been on both sides of that.
Been on both sides.
And I relate more to the production assistant side of things. So it was like, it was a little surreal. And then it was funny to be in front of a camera. They're like, jump around and smile. And I'm like, I usually just smile when I'm happy or someone says something funny. He's like, imagine something funny.
Yeah.
Like, it was a weird experience, but it was cool. And it happened to be at a good time because Greenpeace was working internationally on a campaign called Detox that was focused on shifting the fashion industry. Because a lot of clothes are manufactured with toxic chemical processes.
Yep.
And the runoff and the toxic effluents pollute waterways, usually in the non-industrialized world and areas where people aren't, you know, they don't have the resources to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And so by getting, there's like, it was sort of cool to have a profile in a fashion publication at a time when we were running this international campaign targeting fashion companies.
Yeah, because I totally think there's something that's great timing, but there's totally something to like, just like the corporations have a brand that you're negotiating with, like you don't want to be known as a brand that doesn't care about the environment because your people do. The same thing has to happen in the nonprofit sector of a lot of people in the world care about fashion.
Right.
And it's a thing. And so how can we reach that population in a different way? That's maybe like, they're not like stereotypically, the models are not going to be the ones that stop and talk to you outside of Trader Joe's because they're probably not going to Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
But they have a lot of access and money. And so it's a smart approach to using a corporate tool for good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And I don't like to think of them as like mutually exclusive. I think that like to be effective, there's got to be an overlap. And and I think that's happening more and more. Like Gucci just announced that they're not going to be using animal fur in their new collections.
Oh, great.
Good.
That's awesome.
So great if you're out there, if you can buy Gucci.
If you can buy Gucci.
Yeah.
I'll look at it and I'll be very proud of them, but I can't afford to.
I'll be like, that faux fur is the best faux fur I've ever seen and I can't afford.
But that was it. But I think that has like, a lot of people are not out there. I'm sure they're doing well, but like people are like, I think they're seeing that story. And I think that also has an impact because that's like a sort of a cultural, like they have the power to shift culture. So if you're like, if Gucci's not going to mess with fur, then you're like, well, maybe I shouldn't.
Yeah.
Gucci's cool. I'm not cool. I want to be cooler.
So for our listeners, what are some ways you think that they can get involved with Greenpeace or ways that they can, you know, kind of get inspired in the ways that you were, so that they can take their next step towards their activism and it doesn't have to be necessarily in terms of the environment, but just in ways to get involved.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of different like entry points to this sort of like resistance work or to sort of like living a values based life and practice. Mm-hmm. I think most people start with like education and making like individual choices, which is a good place to start. And I think that like a lot of people that I work with, they kind of reluctantly got into activism because they're like, oh, fuck, do I really have to like change the world? Yeah. And then you realize at a certain point in time, like, yeah, me doing this, and this personally is having a limited impact. So I think that it's figuring out like what matters most to you and what you feel like aligns with your purpose. Mm-hmm. And then identifying like, ways to connect your efforts with the efforts of others. And there's lots of ways to do that. Like it's been like people showing up and going to some of the marches that have been happening has an impact. Like that's changing like the way that we think about some issues. There are a lot of people that engage in the online space and they're liking and retweeting and sharing. Yeah. And that has an impact too. There's that sort of broad culture work everybody has the opportunity to participate in. But then I think seeking out opportunities to volunteer and to get or to participate in some sort of action or activity that's organized and to look for organizations that are doing it. Mm-hmm. So for Greenpeace, you can go on the Greenpeace website. There is a tab. I think it's a tab for like.
Oh, yeah. It says donate.
Yeah.
There's that donate. One.
Top right button. Donate.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's orange.
Yeah. Definitely donate. Mm-hmm. But you can also click to volunteer. Mm-hmm. And we have an online organizing platform called GreenWire. And that's a space where you can make an account and see who else is trying to volunteer and be active in your community and reach out to them like and work with the national organizing team to like get a toolkit with tactics in it and then go do it with your friends.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, go to get involved and then volunteer. Mm.
So that's
take action.
So greenpeace.org. And then you'll see the links for what they're doing, how it works, get involved. You can give some money, donate.
Monthly donations are the best for nonprofits. I'm just going to put it out there.
That's so true.
It's so true because we just need cash flow.
Well, and also for planning, like if you're going to want to work with an organization that's going to plan strategically. And it's a lot easier to make long-term plans. That makes sense.
Even if it's $5 a month. I'd rather have $5 a month than like $100 up front.
Mm-hmm. Were you about to say a million?
I was, and then I was like, but I'd rather have a million than $5. Because $5 a month would be a long time to give $1 million.
Yeah.
So that had to
like
lower
200
my,
years.
Yeah.
Well, Justin, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This has been a treat.
It has. And do you have any social media that people can follow you at?
I do, but not like professional social media. If you want to like my Instagram. I'm not really like super active in the social media space.
For sure. Well, you are super active around the world and helping with a lot of like renewable energies and with Greenpeace. And
Greenpeace is active in the social space.
Yes, and making things better. So
follow Greenpeace at USA. Yeah. And that's also a great way. And any other groups that like, I think that it will recommend groups to you now, which is kind of like a little creepy. Like if you add Greenpeace USA, I'm sure it'll be like, and you should follow Planned Parenthood and Amnesty International. Like it'll be probably, but you should.
Yeah.
And most Earth major organizations Justice. Have great like they have great social media teams actively trying to let you know what you can do to help.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, guys, again, that was Justin D'Angona, the National Frontline Campaigns Manager for Greenpeace. We are We Rebel. If you guys want to contact us, we're WeRebelPodcast@gmail.com. Where
we love
rebel.
Emails.
Yep, we do. We're We Rebel at Apple Podcasts, at We Rebel on Instagram and on Twitter. Yeah.
At We Rebel Podcast.
Oh.
Don't forget the podcast part. There might be a We Rebel.
We've done this over 40 times.
Uh-huh.
We should know this by now.
Yep.
You know, we just switch it up every once in a while.
Thanks for listening.
What a weird note to end on.
Thank you very much. Hey, all right. We'll see you next
Bye.
Week.
Bye. Thanks.
This is Patrick.
And this is Mark, co-host of Nintendo Cartridge Society.
Every Tuesday and Thursday, we're your home for all things Nintendo.
On Tuesday, we're talking about the latest Nintendo news.
And on Thursday, we're doing deep dives into specific corners of the Nintendo universe.
Ranking the Koopa Kids.
Determining who the best Smash Fighter is.
That's Nintendo Cartridge Society on Campfire Media or wherever you get your podcasts.
Campfire.